But in my early days, I was guilty of perhaps being too enthusiastic or too motivated or too lively, or, you know, where I was trying to force people into kind of moving towards a better place. Whereas now I think I'm better at taking my cue from the person I'm working with.
That is Simply Focused with Avery Cherney and Dominic Gouda for Live and Joy and Deep.
Are you ready for this new episode? Then please welcome your hosts, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godad.
Hello and welcome back to episode number 98 of the Simply Focus podcast.
Hello everyone, and hello Rob. It's so great to see you.
Glad to see you too.
We're here today with Rob Black from the United Kingdom, from Bath Spa University, and we are so excited to finally do this interview. We met each other at the UK SFP conference last year that you organized together with Guy Shannon and a group of lovely, amazing people at your university. And we had the honor to be part of it and also to spend some really great time together where we have so many lovely memories. So thank you very much.
And you organized the most stunning parking spot for our party. You'll find a picture in the resource section of this podcast. It was so lovely to be there and just to enjoy this conference, this beautiful, wonderful setting around Bath Spa University. And yeah, we're happy that we can meet online right now and are very happy to meet you someday live in person again.
Let's hope so, yeah.
Rob, you're an accredited solution-focused practitioner by the UK SFP. You're a qualified social worker. You're a clinical team leader at Bath Spa University. And most of all, you're a wonderful human being. So.
And you used to be a musician.
I did, many, many years ago, yeah. Played in lots of unsuccessful bands, which is why I'm sat here, I guess, talking to you guys.
Well, we are very, very lucky to have you here and also to have you talk about your amazing work you do over so many years and in different settings and fields. And yeah, to start with, what is it, Rob, that fascinates you about solution focus?
A good question, big question. I think for me, it's just its flexibility. So I've done various roles over the last 23 years with various client groups, but this way of talking or communicating or working seems to be adaptable. And yes, and what fascinates me, there's always something new to learn. So each year, I obviously attend conferences like yourselves, so I meet lots of wonderful people, and I think there's always something new to learn, a little gem of knowledge or an idea which can help improve one's clinical work. So still learning 20 however many years it is on, and I guess I'm still not bored of it. It's just a very exciting way to work, because coming from the not knowing, every conversation is different. So that's what fascinates me, I guess, and the way people respond. I mean, I just had a session last week in this kind of virtual world, and it's been tough, I have to say, adapting to this way of working. And I think we had a brief conversation before we started about trusting the process. And I was faced with, it was a mature teaching student who'd been through quite a difficult situation even prior to this covert situation. And she was pretty much in a very kind of chaotic, desperate place. So I was trying to ask helpful questions. And she kept saying, "I don't understand. I don't understand. You're supposed to tell me what to do. I'm in distress here. You need to tell me what to do." So I persisted with my questions. And I don't know, but she said she wanted to meet again, but it didn't seem like a very constructive ending. And then it was the third session in, and then she kind of resolved the situation. She said, "I didn't really understand what you're asking in the first session." I kept thinking, what is this question, hopes? What is this person talking about? But the way she then reflected on some of the answers to some of my questions, she said it started to make a bit more sense. Yeah, so it was interesting.
So you say it's flexible, you can adapt it. In what settings are you adapting?
So originally by my core training, I was a social worker, and I worked at, it was a project which was set up to work with young people on the edge of care. That was where my core training was. So fundamentally, our role was to support families in staying together. So I spent maybe, God, I can't think how many years doing it. So that was a very good grounding for me. And then I got more interested in mental health. So I decided to apply for a job in a community mental health team. So different client groups, same age group, slight differences in language and how you might phrase questions or things you might use. But fundamentally, the principles were the same. And again, I mean, I wasn't 100% successful, but successful enough for me to warrant my place within that team. And now, over 5 years ago, I took the older end of the spectrum and some mature students as well. I think one of my oldest clients since I've been here was 82, I think. So that was a challenge for me. So again, different client group, different context, but the principles remained the same. So that's what I mean by flexible, adaptable. It's you can adhere the principles to any kind of setting, really. That's what I mean by flexibility. There's no rigidity to it.
And when you mentioned differences in language, what differences did you observe kind of through different client groups?
I guess when I was working in social care, I mean, that's the thing I miss about being here. I used to love working with young people. That was my original passion. And I guess in terms of client group, young people are really flexible. They like change. They change their music tastes all the time, their partners, their interests. So in my core work, I was very keen to adapt those elements. I mean, we call it resource talk now, but it was problem-free talk. I used to spend a lot of time trying to get a sense of the person, so connecting with that person, what motivates them, what interests them. And then I would somehow try and use some of that knowledge in terms of how I would frame questions. So I used to use the phrase, bringing the boundaries of the conversation into the vision of the young person. So I've had conversations about SpongeBob SquarePants, musicians, actresses, films, and try to adapt that language to formulate some kind of helpful question.
Problem-free talk was quite common in the early days, and it's not really used much anymore, but can still really get information and language to use.
Yeah. In terms of connecting with people, I think it's really fundamentally important to acknowledge that they are people in their own right in the first instance. And I think that open dialogue, if you show an interest in someone, they're more likely to come along with you on that kind of journey. And I think that phrase connection, and I'll probably get shot down for this here, but I think connection is fundamentally important to any successful work. And I've had this conversation with lots of colleagues over the years, but if I'm honest to myself, hand on heart, and if my memory serves me correct, my most successful outcomes with clients, I've always had a sense within the first 10 minutes with speaking with someone, there is some kind of connection there. They think, yeah, this guy seems all right. I'm happy for him to ask me questions or something along those lines. But I think connection is pretty key, to be honest. And if you look at any Scott Miller's work, I mean, that would kind of bore that out, to be honest. But probably not a popular viewpoint, but I'm just saying connection works for me.
I like that. It works for me certainly too. And I would say it works for us very well too. And talking Good. About connection and talking about working with young people and families, what was it that supported you in connecting with young people? And what's maybe special when it comes to connecting with young people?
I think the biggest thing I learned when I made the transition into doing kind of more therapeutic solution focus, I used to be involved before I qualified as a social worker. And I always thought you had to, I think the phrase is get down with the kids, you know, and show them that you know what they're talking about, which is ludicrous, really. So when I made this kind of the switch to more therapeutic work, I kind of got a sense that didn't really matter. You just had to show an interest in them. And they're more than happy to tell you about the things you don't know than you trying to convince them that you're cool or you know what they're talking. So that was a bit of an eye-opener for me. I mean, when I first came across this model, I hated it, absolutely hated it. So I was at this residential unit and it's a children's home. And they were going to close the unit and open up this team, this intervention team. And then we were presented with this woman called Eileen Murphy, just started talking about, so this is what we're going to be doing. And I'm like, really? Miracle? God, you know, I'm thinking about my young people at the time, thinking if I ask that to my young people, this is not going to go well, like, you know. But I was open to the idea of free training. So we spent at least 6 months with Eileen, just teaching us the basics, the principles, the ideas. And I'm still thinking this is too simple. This will never work, you know. And then we were very lucky. So when the project opened, I even saw the first families and we were allowed to go in and observe. And then the way it kind of worked was if we felt confident enough to ask a question, we could interject. But I'm there still with my circle head thinking, right, here we go. So let's see how this kind of works. So I'm sat there with this pen and paper. This family comes in, you know, quite a challenging family. And I just see Eileen work. And I'm like, did that just happen? She asked that question and it took a bit of time, but they answered the question and my jaw kind of dropped really. And from then I was kind of, okay, there might be some end to this for me. I can see how this might work for me. And I think that's kind of borne out. I mean, the way I've kind of developed my practice, why I enjoy solution-focused work is a lot of my training and teaching is actually watching people do the work. Hmm. So it's not just about learning the principles of the idea. It's then how that applies in practice. I don't know, you obviously know Ben Furman. So he told this joke about, you know, the Americans invented this tractor and the Russians got to hear about this tractor. So they rang up the Americans and said, look, yeah, bring the tractor over. We've heard about this thing. We're really interested in this. You know? So the Americans fly the tractor over Russia and they start showing what the tractor can do. It says, look, it can, you know, pull the weight of 16 horses. It can plow a field within 20 seconds quicker than this, and demonstration. And apparently the Russian goes, looks great in practice, but does it work in theory? Which kind of made me laugh. I mean, I'm not a great theorist. Of course, I know a bit about the principles and what the foundations of what I'm trying to do, but it's the actual doing where I've learned the most from watching people like Chris, Harvey, Evan, Guy to some extent, Eileen, Harry, Ben, all these wonderful people who are so generous with their work. And that's the thing I appreciate about Solution Focus. When I first became part of the community, I was absolutely amazed about how approachable people were and more than willing to want to encourage you to become better.
And you also met Insu and Steve.
I met Insu with Amsterdam, a conference. I used to be part of the SF World Discussion Group. And I think I posted a joke about beer on there once, which Steve took great offense to. He didn't think I was being respectful enough, I think. So that was my brief brush with Steve. And I've been invited to this speak at this conference, do a workshop. And I was still fresh then. So I get invited to this meal with Chris, Harvey, Brian Cade, lots of different people, Insu. So I'm really nervous, thinking, God, you know, all these great people, what can I bring to a conversation here? So I'm sitting there greenly, drinking my red wine, probably drinking more than I should because my nerves are like this. So they're having this fascinating debate. And I'm listening. And then they said, oh, what do you want to bring to the table, Rob? Okay. I don't know where it came from. I just thought, I'm just going to get to predict the English Premier League football scores for the weekend. I turned to Insu, I go, Sunderland, Brighton. She said, sorry? I said, predict the score, Insu. Well, what's the score going to be for Sunderland, Brighton? She said, oh, 3-2. And then we went through the cards. So I was just sitting there getting to recite football scores stupidly. It was quite embarrassing. But.
And was she right?
I can't remember. Probably no, Insu. Yeah, I don't know. But it was just one of those embarrassing moments where I didn't know what to do. I was petrified. I didn't want to make myself look stupid. So I just tried to use a bit of comic humor, which, you know, I don't know.
Well, I really love this story, particularly when you think that with what brilliant ideas people come up with surrounded by all different kind of people. So.
Well, I was completely out of my depth. That was the only thing I had some, you know, I thought it might be funny, but I don't know if Chris thought it was funny. I'm sure you could ask him. I don't know.
And it's a great story to tell afterwards anyway. So, talking about stories, talking about connections, and talking about solution-focused work. So you're a very good friend with Guy Shannon. Guy is a very, very big fan of your work as well. And he kept saying, like, I keep pestering Rob to get out with his messages and ideas around working with young people. So what would Guy love to see you talk on this podcast?
I guess not so much now, because I'm in this context, but when I was a social worker doing solution focused, I was a lot more creative then. So I can see you've got a flip chart in your room there. I would always, even if I was going to home visit, maybe take a flip chart or some strength cards or just anything that I think might be helpful in engaging that young person into a conversation about hopes, really. I mean, yeah, some of my earlier sort of tapes that I had the privilege of recording probably showed me when I was a bit more, well, I was a lot younger then, but a lot more creative, really, and a lot, I think, braver, perhaps, you know, because I guess when you're working with families, it's almost like the parents are putting their trust in you to a degree. And sometimes when you're sitting there asking questions, and I can remember one session I did. So basically, it's a young chap who's been out of school for about a year. He's been to all the kind of obvious, like, education department. And they pretty much all asking the same question. So why don't you go to school? Which I don't think is a bad question, because lots of young people can answer that question that I'm being bullied or, but this young person consistently has been saying, I don't know, I don't want to talk about that, you know? So he does it for the session with his mum. And it's a pretty difficult situation for her, because what the authorities are saying is if he doesn't start attending school, we're going to take you to court and we're going to fine you. So she's in a difficult situation. And the boy comes in with the coat on, sits down in the chair, and you can see in his head, he's thinking, I just need to hear the question. Why don't I go to school? I say I don't want to talk about it, and then I'm out of here. So I start off the conversation. I'm just, okay, so tell me a bit about yourself, you know, and sorry? I said, well, what do you enjoy doing? Is there anything you're interested in? So he starts talking about he likes music and he likes athletics, running, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we try to get a sense of if he knows why he's there. I said, whose idea was it for you to come here? And he said, well, that's my mum and the education department. And this is something I got for into. So what do you think they were hoping to see happen as a result of you talking to me? And he said, well, I think they want me to go to school. Okay, so he leans forward, thinking here comes the question. I said, okay, that's really clear. So what would your hopes be? And he just stops. And I guess this is something I've really worked on over the years. I'm very energetic, but I think silence is one key element that I've really tried to work on. So his mum's looking at me and I'm not saying anything. It's about 15, 20 seconds before he says, oh, I don't know. So in my head, I think, okay, so he's 20 seconds is a long time. So he's thinking about this question. I just need to find a way of asking it, which would probably make more sense to him. So I said, okay, so how did you get here today? Did you come with mum? He said, yeah, in the car. I said, so as you were taking that journey in that car, I said, what were you hoping was going to happen as a result of our conversation today? Another 10 seconds. Mum's looking at me like this. She said, what are you doing? Like, boy says, I don't know. Like, okay, so I nod my head and I can feel mum's looking at me thinking, what is this guy trying to achieve here? I feel a bit like a swan. So on the top, I'm calm. Legs are kind of paddling frantically, thinking like this. So then I say, okay, so suppose, you know, by the end of our conversation, you walk away, you think it's not been a complete waste of time. Because I guess I don't want to waste your time because you're very busy, you young people. I guess you don't want to waste my time. So what would you be leaving with, which would suggest it's been a good use of your time? And then he says, oh, some idea of something. So I'm happy. I've got a response. And he's thinking, mum's still thinking, well, we've come all this way for this, you know. And I've used this tape in training. So I stopped when I used to do training, is to stop the tape at that point and say, okay, what's your next question? Is that a contract? And so yeah, you've got a contract there. I said, well, no, it's a bit vague. You know, some idea of something could be how to make ice cream, could be how to fly a jumbo jet, could be how to kind of French kiss girls. I don't know what this idea is. You know, we've got to develop it a bit more. So then I said, okay, if the idea tends to be a useful idea, this idea of something, what are you hoping it's going to lead to? You know, and then he says, guess what I can do to get back into school? And then mum smiles, thinking, okay, we're on the right track here. And I probably did, I think, four sessions with that family, and it was successful. But what was really key, and again, in the teaching, we never get to find out why he never goes to school. I don't know if that's an interesting story, just made me.
It certainly is. And I just love how you in this story show how important it is, like what you mentioned earlier, to, on the one hand, trust the process.
Yeah.
And then also embracing the silence and trusting the resources that the other person together with you and the other people in the room can come up with a resourceful answer that might lead to change, to a change towards a preferred future.
Yeah, and I think for me that was the hardest transition, was not being afraid of silence. And I don't know who taught me this, but this, you know, this whole idea of a conversation being like a dance. And once you've done your bit, it's the next person's turn, you come back. So it's almost like you dance together. And being mindful that obviously if there is a gap in someone's answer, it's either they're not particularly happy with the question or don't really understand it, or actually what you've just asked me is absolutely a huge thing that I need some time to kind of process. And just not being afraid. Because if you'd watched some of my early embarrassing sessions, if someone didn't answer a question within 5 seconds, I'd be bang, another question. Okay, didn't like that one, bang. Almost like trying to machine gun them into kind of submission. You know, like, you will answer my question, you will answer my question. But now it's like, okay, it sounds simple, best hopes, or how might this be useful? But if someone's not been asked that question before, it's massive, massive. So I think we really need to be respectful and give people space and time to process that, really.
And it's also nice to hear how you try to make your next question fit this kind of trial and also error process and see, okay, let's try this and see if that fits better.
Yeah.
And then take what you get and use that for your next question, maybe co-construct another, maybe even better question.
And I think that is, for me, I mean, that's still an ongoing learning process. And I can think back to when I was very fortunate. For a while, I was invited to brief once a month to sit and watch sessions and then be part of the kind of summary team. So I learned so much. And that's where I think connection. If you look at Chris, Harvey and Evan, how they work is completely different. And part of that process, we used to do exercises about doing a session where you could only formulate your next question from the previous answer. Man, was that hard. And I still really, that is something I grapple with on a daily basis. Again, another example this week, I had a student who was fairly distressed, but I asked best hopes. You know, he just said, I just want someone to talk to. So then I have to make the decision. He's clearly saying that, but I still want to be curious about how the talk is going to be helpful. And I think pace is a really important thing. So almost like mirroring the client's presentation. And I guess when in my early days, I was guilty of perhaps being too enthusiastic or too motivated or too lively, or, you know, where I was trying to force people into kind of moving towards a better place. Whereas now I think I'm better at taking my cue from the person I'm working with.
So what I read the other day in More Than Miracles, and they were writing about scaling questions and how to formulate scaling questions. And then one line was there where they said, never get more enthusiastic than your client about something, because then you turn into their parent.
They already have
a parent. And this was really like, wow, this is so true. And while knowing myself, I'm very, very enthusiastic, particularly when people tell amazing stories. And I feel that I'm often more amazed than they are. And I think there's room for that, but not in a coaching or in a therapy session.
Yeah. And I think that's key. It's really hard, or to be mindful, not to bring other information as well. I mean, so another story I could tell is when I worked in the CAMS team, I started working with who had assessed it on the hospital ward, who connected with me and that was interested in working with me. She'd done all the other stuff before, CBT, family therapy, whether that had worked. I had a first session, which I thought it seemed okay. It seemed to be a good fit. Second session seemed okay. And then subsequently, I saw her for quite a few months. And every time I said, what's been better? She'd say, oh, nothing. It's actually no better. And so lots of coping questions. So I'm sort of 10 sessions in, can you imagine? I think I'm not sure this is helping this. So I'd say, just need to check. Is this still helpful? Yeah, it's really helpful, really helpful. Okay. What's been there? Nothing. Yeah. Okay. And then I get the school ringing me, said, I don't know what you're doing in your sessions, but she's a different person. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, she's head of, you know, got an A in psychology. She's rejoined the netball team. She's engaging with friends. And I'm like, really? Because she's not telling me this, you know. I so wanted to say, hold on a minute. Now, I spoke to your school. They're telling me this. They're telling me that. But of course you can't, because you have to go from the client's perception.
How did you do not to ask that? I mean, this is amazing.
But then it's not coming from her. It's me imparting third-party information, which is not going to be as effective. Ironically, she's a mental health nurse now. We're in touch. She's done some teaching with me. This is incredible. But she left CAMS because she became 18. And then she sent me this letter, which was kind of clearly explaining what was helpful about the whole process. And I've got a picture of this. I use it in a presentation. It's just a mug with, like, in punk lettering, because that's my background, said, Rob, what's been better? ? Oh, classic.
This is awesome.
Classic.
This also reminds me of that we can never know what happens in people's lives, and that what they tell us is just a little part of, well, what we co-construct together. Reminds me of a session I once had. It's a complete different story, but it just kind of reminded me of that. When I was HR manager, I went and had a conversation with two employees that were really in the fight and asked all those questions. We had that 1 hour, all those questions, and they just did not answer. Whenever someone started saying something, they started fighting again. And after, like, I don't know, 50 or 55 minutes, I thought, well, this is not helpful at all. And I said, well, you know what? I don't see any progress here. Well, looks like it's not helpful at all. And they looked at each other and said, well, we sorted everything out. We know what to do and we have the same opinion. Like, what? We're fighting for 55 minutes now and I don't believe you. And within 5 minutes, they told me everything they now want to do. And they were completely agreeing on that. They had no clue for 55 minutes about what they were talking about. They did not agree at all in my view. But within 5 minutes, they agreed on everything and it worked out fine. Well, I met them several times because I worked in the same company and was like, what is going on? This is completely a session that I don't want to repeat again. It's awful. And for them, it was the most helpful thing that could happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of coming back to the point we talked about, seeing solution focus in practice, that's when it makes sense. So when I've joined different teams, which I have, and I try to explain what I do, they just look at me like, well, that's it, is it? You ask someone what they want, you ask them what that might look like, and you ask them what they're doing already. I say, that's pretty much it, but there's a lot more to it than that. But fundamentally, and until you see it, I guess I'm guilty of that. I was like, but when you see in practice, that's when it starts to make sense. And that's when you see, I mean, there's a great, I don't know if you read Elliot's book, The Art of Solution-Focused Therapy, where he interviews lots of therapists about this idea of it being an art form. And I think that just makes so much sense to me. It's in terms, yeah, it is. It's not just a mindset, it's from my perception. And something, I guess, I've just been trying to become better at each year. Mm. I'm not there yet by any stretch, but I'm still learning things, and there's bits of practice that I pick up from, like, say, Guy or Chris. Yeah, so many great people I've taken ideas from. And I think that's what's impressive about our community. We're like an open source community where we all give things, but we also take things back. Mm. And I think that makes us quite different from other modalities, possibly.
It also reminds me of your former career as a musician in music, or with music. It's what just playing guitar. Of course, but B.B. King is played completely different than Slash, for example, or those other players, and we are still learning. It's something that amazes me longer the more that now is the moment in time where we learn the most at the moment. And I've been saying that for the last 10 years.
And for me, it's like every day I do this with a student, I learn something different. And I guess, again, trying to switch my mindset. Sometimes I kind of dread sessions, but then I think, hold on a minute, you know, this is probably going to be more helpful, because the more difficult it is, the more you've got to really reevaluate and think. So if every session was straightforward, then I probably wouldn't be learning that much, to be honest. So sometimes our most difficult clients can be our most helpful clients in some ways.
And talking about learning and learning every day, you just shared with us earlier that you really were not as appreciative of working virtually with clients. And now, to the situation around COVID-19, Corona, you had to, or at least in your team, you decided that you will continue your work with your students. So what helped you in this transition phase?
In terms of our service, I mean, we are a well-being service, and students are still funding the university. We're still being allowed to come and use the space here. So it's more about meeting students than my own therapeutic needs. Although I would never say I'm qualified to do this, I think I had to remind myself of that phrase, trust the process, because I was a bit nervous about, given that people are stuck in a pandemic and in lockdown, asking questions about hopes, even contemplating asking a preferred teacher question. But then I thought, well, no, you just have to reframe the question so it's relevant to the context of what's happening now. And ironically, I mean, what's been quite funny, well, I guess funny's not, well, yeah, my students did laugh, so yeah, funny, is a lot of my, not that I like diagnosis, but my socially anxious students, when I say, okay, no, this is great, we love being at home, just doing our work on a computer and not having to go to lectures, or I'm succeeding, I don't have to face this. It's been, quite eye-opener, really, in lots of ways. But again, it's a strength that I've developed. I mean, I've been doing this for 6 weeks now. I definitely feel more confident, and it's definitely opened up my eyes to the possibility of moving forward when we come out of this, that this could definitely be a useful resource, because we have a lot of teaching students at this university who are on placement. And so it was really hard for them to fit into the schedule of our timetable. So I used to have like one slot on a Friday at 4 o'clock, which the teaching students would try and grab. But now, because this has been okay, we could be a bit more flexible in terms of what we offer. So it's been a bit of a blessing, really. And I shouldn't be so narrow-minded and cynical about, you know, it has to be face-to-face. It has to be with a real person for it to be effective, and, you know, the alliance and all that kind of stuff.
And this is amazing, like what you just say, looking at what we are doing right now in this situation where we are not supposed to meet each other face-to-face. And what can we learn from this situation? What is useful here that we can take further into the future? And we heard so many amazing stories from people who took this focus and really developed kind of new ideas and built on what worked in this situation. Yeah. We are so curious of what will emerge out of that, because I think that stories of hope, that stories, like we used to say, that's the campfire stories of tomorrow that we could create here right now.
And I think what's interesting, the phrase you just used there, something I've noticed about myself recently, is sometimes when I've come to conclude a piece of work with a client, I would often ask, so what have you learned from this experience? And then I kept thinking, well, is that learned? So what I've noticed myself doing more recently is, what have you discovered about yourself during this experience? I know, for me personally, it's a nicer question.
I fully agree. So it brings in this idea of observing, of staying curious about what's working. And I love discovery.
Yeah.
So what else have you discovered lately about yourself?
I'm just very fortunate, really. You know, as difficult as it's been for me, I can't imagine what it's like for the students. And the fact that I can come into this room, and we talked about this earlier. I mean, I think my students would struggle it if I was doing virtual sessions from home with my dog barking or my teenager calling out. But because it's the room that I would normally meet students with anywhere, there's so much quite contained. So I've learned that I can be flexible. I can be a bit more open-minded. Yeah, and I'm just really grateful for what I have, really. I mean, in terms of, I'm still getting paid. Some people aren't, you know. My family are healthy. I'm still managing to do work. And hopefully a lot of the students feeding back that it's been helpful. And that, I guess that's my drive in terms of evidence base. I mean, since I've been here, part of my journey, I've constantly been challenged by other professionals who work in a different way, saying there's no evidence base for what I do, or it could never work with this type of client, it could never work with that type of client. So I set up a pretty basic evaluation process when I became clinical team lead here. And the evidence is boring out, you know, that my work is as effective as someone who just interests humanistic, or someone who's a psychotherapist or CBT. So I think that's fundamentally important, that we are seen as equals or as relevant,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, that's very important. And there's a strong evidence base.
Well, there
is,
yeah.
Happy that you do it for yourself. And there's so many people out there that also do it. And we can point you to some of the podcasts about the evidence base of solution-focused practice. Just last week, we talked to Cynthia Franklin, for example, the podcast with Johnny Kim. So you'll find that in the resource section of this podcast. So Rob, you got in contact in 97 and you said you hated it.
Yeah, because then I saw there was something in this and I started to get the concept and I thought this is okay. And I started after a few sessions, which weren't great, rubbish questions and saying all your problems and just getting everything wrong. And then I thought, well, I need to do a bit more training. So I go up to Brief in London for a two-day workshop with Chris Iveson. And this is such a funny story. That's the first time I've ever met Chris as well. So he starts off, this was at Shine & Move, the early days, like that. So it's big room, big group. And he just starts off saying, Chris Iveson, I just want to show you, you know, I think this is probably the best work I've done. And this probably encapsulates SF, you know. So we're sitting there like this. And he shows his tape. And there's this young chap in there. He's about 15 with his social worker. And Chris is going, so what are your best hopes? He's going, he's just like this. And then Chris formulates another question. And eventually this young person just goes, falls asleep in the chair. And I'm like, is this guy for real? Has he just shown me a clip of someone just falling asleep in the chair? And I don't know what he said, but it was really funny. And so Chris, after riding, I call them my surrogate solution-focused parents, really. So pretty much my training was then undertaken with Chris. So Chris is very generous. And I kept saying, well, you know, if I get sort of stuck with a client, is it okay to kind of bring them up? He said, yeah, absolutely. Not a problem. If you ever want a bit of supervision advice. So I was working with this young chap, 15-year-old, quite a roughy, toughy 15-year-old. And he thought I was great. Connection was there, but I got nowhere with him. You know, just thought I was great, you know. So it's not really that helpful. So I think, right, I'm going to take him to see Chris because I think, just check out if I'm getting this right, what am I missing here. So I had to get permission from his mum to take him to London. His mum said, that's fine, if it's going to be helpful. So we go off, me and this 15-year-old. So we're sat in Bruce in Chris's room. Chris comes in. There's like 12 people watching this session, yeah, students. And it starts off quite well. Yeah, so Chris introduces himself and talks to me and talks to, we'll call him Roger, this client. That's not his name, but Roger. So he talks about hopes. And I think they did manage to get some kind of sense of what might be good. But I thought to myself in my head, well, I've asked him that question, pretty much got the same answer. And then he starts to say, okay, so let's say you woke up tomorrow and this young person goes, I don't know. Chris persists. Young person getting more and more irritated. And then he says, oh, well, let's say there was a miracle. So this young person says to Chris, you know, fuck your miracles. If you ask me that again, I'm going to punch your lights out, mate. And I'm like this, thinking, oh, shit, they're never going to let me in Brief again. Someone just threatened to punch Chris Iveson in the face. And he said, I'm going to have a cigarette. And he storms out, you know, this young person. And I'm thinking, okay, what do I do now? Okay, so if he's gone off into London, I'm probably going to get struck off the social work list. Client goes missing. And I'm thinking, I don't know what to do. And then Chris just starts saying, okay, Rob, so what would you notice about your client if, you know, things started to improve? I'm like, okay. So he starts interviewing me. He starts writing these answers up. So some about leadership. So I'll give some examples of when this young person's demonstrated leadership and all these things. And then about sort of 20 minutes later, this young person comes back in the room, sits down next to me. And he just looks to me and says, "What do you mean leadership?" And I'm thinking, "Well, how do you know that leadership's on the board?" Like, you know, I think, well, I said that time you ran that group successfully. I said, "How do you know that was up there?" So I've just been watching you upstairs with all the students, like being interviewed by Chris. And so when I realized you were just giving me compliments and Chris was, I thought, well, that's okay. I can sit down and get sex and compliments. So keep them coming. And I'm like, so he just sat in the room with these students watching me being interviewed about him. And then what the most amazing thing, well, I'm not sure where Chris got this from. So at the end, when they give the feedback, and he said, oh, all those students give their feedback as well. So all these students come down and they feed it back. The last thing Chris said to him was, the thing that really impressed me, Roger, is you were very loyal. You're such a loyal person. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, you weren't going to let some hotshot therapist do better than your social worker, were you, with these questions? He said, too fucking right I was. Mm. And then it ended. Mm. Wow. Sorry, I don't know if that's a good story, but just I've got it on tape somewhere. But just that wow. Chris's composure was, it was a long time ago. But yeah. But then I've had the fortune of doing some great stuff with fascinating people, really, who have always been supportive of me. So I guess, I mean, I'm not a great theorist. I think what I enjoy the most is actually doing the work. Mm. I mean, I can do a few lectures and I do a bit of training. I'm quite good at introducing people to the idea, but I think that that's where we're at. So my contribution is that, really, I think, and occasionally organising a conference which might generate some funding for the association and bring some like-minded people together. I like the interaction. That's the bit I like.
Yeah, so let our listeners do something with the challenge of the week.
Okay. The biggest challenge for me, once I got over the cynical bit, was just this idea of silence being helpful. So perhaps if people are working with clients, if they can look at and notice the times when they used silence effectively and the difference that made in terms of the interaction or the conversation, I think that might be a helpful thing.
And of course, we are curious and we would love to hear it without silence. What do you encounter when doing this challenge of the week? We would like to read it. So go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 98 and comment on what was useful, what was inspiring the podcast with Rob. Comment what you discovered in the challenge of the week, because what inspired you might also be inspiring for someone else and might also help the other person to go their solution-focused journey.
And please also go to the resource section. You will find Rob's website there. You will find all the resources we mentioned. Just go on www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 98.
Rob, it was a huge pleasure meeting you online again here on Zoom. And thank you so much for sharing your stories. There were so many inspiring things in there. And we're curious to also see what differences those stories will make for us in our future.
And as you know, hopefully know, we are big fans of you, of your work, and of, well, just interacting with you, because it always brings something new and it always brings great feeling of connection to us. So yeah, thank you very, very much for that.
That's important, connection. I'm going to slip that in there again.
So let's stay connected and meet next week again in episode number 99. Yeah. So thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Wow, what a great episode again.
This was Simply Focused Podcast with Alfie Cherney and Dominic Godin.
Your podcast for a life in joy and ease.
That's important, connection. I'm going to slip that in there again.